and I am on the way to hell. What is this to you? Leave me alone!
I'll write it and we'll do it live. And thing sucks.
On WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schmid is brilliant and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. It's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Spin of History here on WBAI at New York. I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmid. But it's just about time for Gene Shepherd. Maybe we'll get off the air on time for once tonight. That would be a novelty. I still have time for the opening here. Look at the closing theme. All right, so let me look here. I haven't even chosen our Gene Shepherd for the evening. Jim Clavin, kind enough to select, 5 or 6 episodes and sent them along so that I would have something to pick from. So let's see. Let me check. What's today's date? Today's date, 21st, or just the tail end of the 20th. Maybe we should hear the one from this day in history, huh? What do you think? Okay, but to do that, we need to load it into the playback machine. Sherman to the playback machine. All right, let's see. Where did I put those things? I got so many folders called Shep. Let's see if it's in this folder. Hines from Jim. Yes, indeed. All right. So we're going to hear an episode, which I have not heard. I have no details on it whatsoever, except that it was originally broadcast over WOR-FM, I assume, on August 20th, 1963. It's called Essex Adventures. Runs 45 minutes, almost to the on the nose. So, we move it on over. Slide it on over. Now we'll load it on in. And listen to Lost Gene Shepherd. Available nowhere else but here in the dustbin of history. WBAI New York.
Still out there in the world, walking around, bumping into things, getting the sun in your eyes, hoping that it's going to work out all right. And you know, it is. It's just, believe me, we don't have a master hold or a top. Hey, come on, let's go, Walt. We don't have a master hold here on the grip. Now hold it there on the on nuttiness in the world. And tonight. Well, I've got to warn you one thing about it tonight. If there are any women and children listening, I would suggest you go down where they're playing those soft, long-playing records. You know? Matter of fact, I understand that everybody in a few years is going to be internally wired to pick up soft, long-playing records. Do you know that the big GE or Westinghouse or RCA type places is working on a set of electrical circuits, tiny transistorized receivers and transmitters too, that can be inserted in a person's muscles. Yes, right in your muscles. And you can be controlled then from a long distance, from far off, with a radio transmitter. And your muscle will pick up the signal. It will say, move forward, turn to left, pick up ball. Your muscles do it, and you cannot do anything about it because, you know how your muscle works. There's this little electrical impulse, you know, that is sent from your brain down through your nerves to your nerve endings, and it says to the muscle, all right, go. You know, little shot of electricity, ping, goes into the, yeah, that's the way it works. Now, you can reproduce that, of course, electronically, you know, by putting a little transistor receiver there in the circuit. And it picks up that little impulse. Instead of from your brain, it gets it from the master station, which broadcasts it. Oh, yeah, that's how it works, literally. And they're working on a system because, you know, a lot of people today are very nervous. This is a nervous world. And have you noticed on the buses, everywhere you walk and everywhere you talk and move and sit, there are people walking around with transistor radios plugged right into their ear. You've seen this. It's a growing thing. And you know that in cars, hardly a guy today gets into his car without the radio goes on the instant he gets in there. You know, he's liable to find himself with himself for a minute, and that's very bad, as you know. Now, there's got to be a steady roar of something from outside, from without, to remind the guy that he really does exist, or at least Mantovani exists, or the long playing record exists. That's enough to know. Well, now, there is an actual experiment that has been carried out of a guy having a transistorized receiver placed behind his right ear and grafted onto that little bone. You know, if you put your hand up behind your ear, you'll feel bone there. You know what they call about bone conduction? You know about this? Well, this little thing about the size of a very small pea, little tiny pea there, a little seed, is stuck right into the flesh there, and immediately your flesh grows right over it, you know, no problem there. And it's in there for a long time, you know, just right in there. And it works, it's got a tiny cell, a little tiny battery in there, and it picks up the signal forever. And, of course, the problem is you don't have much choice of programs, and you can't turn it off. That's one of the problems. But then again, most guys don't want to turn it off anyway, and they don't want to change the program anyway, as long as it's just long-playing music that goes on and on and on. So they inserted this behind this guy's ear, and they wanted to see what would happen. And it was funny. After about 3 or 4 weeks of this, you would think he would go out of his skull and go nutty, you know? No, quite the opposite. After 3 or 4 weeks, he walked around with a glassy look in the eye and a big fat smile. There's a great word for that smile. It's a phrase, and he had a big smile. He just sort of walked around, and all the while they were playing music, and they were inserting it right there in the prefrontal lobes, and it was going right in. And nothing else could get in then. That was what was the important thing to remember. Nothing else could get in. Nothing else. And as you are pretty aware, these days we are living in the world where we're negating the intellect. Negating the intellect, and we're putting a great deal of emphasis on the libido. A great deal of emphasis is put on the basic animal passion. Now, nobody wants to say, you know, actually that. Nobody wants to say, well, man, like I got stoned and it was great. No one wants to say that. So what you have to do is form a foundation where you can write up a whole series of philosophical articles about how you're pushing back the edges of perception in mankind by getting stoned. And it's too bad, you know. Oh, poor old Mr. Bruner, he lived before they realized that getting drunk and falling down the stairs was a superb emotional experience and one that was worthy of a foundation and a group at Harvard, you know, the whole thing. Or don't you know what's going on at Harvard, haven't you? Of course, they kicked that crew out, but they're setting up their business all right. So naturally, the brain today is a very... It's being talked down in almost every area you go. You can't. Have you ever tried to talk to a really dedicated crusader of any kind these days? Whether it's a crusader for the right, or a crusader for the left, or a crusader for anything, he doesn't want to hear any kind of logic at all. He says, "Well, I feel that way. It's the way I feel, and the way a man feels is what's important." And they'll argue and argue. So you know that the way a man thinks today is not nearly as important as to the way he feels. But be careful, because a man, and this includes all men, unfortunately, according to several very good psychologists, among them Pavlov, That a man feels a lot of different ways. He's got a lot of emotions going. And he has many things which we do not like to often talk about in that great geranium of attributes that lie within the human kin. You know, like all those things. Like within each one of us, there is a mass axe murderer. Within each one of us. Now, if you begin to say, swing, go in all directions, man, just whatever you feel like doing, go, man, go. Be careful. Some are liable to take it that way. They're liable to go on that course, you know, with the axe and say, well, all right, man, pick it up and go. And how are you going to make the differentiation there? And so, oh, yes, within that great vast geranium. So no matter where you go, you'll find the inexplicable happening. Oh, yes, everywhere. You see little notes in the news occasionally, and I'm keeping this vast file of trivia, you see, which is going to kind of, in a sense, document our world, our time, not just America, but where it is, what's happening, and everywhere you turn. For example,
Radio Tokyo brings you a special one-minute newscast which illustrates the importance of modern living in Japan economy and sociological progress. Radio Tokyo brings you now as public service special one-minute news broadcast. Tokyo, August 14, Associated Press. Arrested for breaking into home of movie starlet Sayori Yoshinaga and shooting a pursuing policeman, Kenji Watanabe, said he only wanted to tattoo his name on the actress. I am a great admirer of Miss Yoshinaga. I have seen every movie she's made, and I wanted to tattoo my name on her arm or leg, the 26-year-old factory worker said. Police said Watanabe was captured carrying homemade pistol and homemade tattoo set. Once again, we bring you on the Radio Tokyo special one-minute news broadcast on progress of civilization in Japan. Stay tuned next for special program of rock and roll hits brought to you under our Golden Hit Parade program.
Now, every reel... There's no question about it. Every genuine movie fan of the 20th century can understand Watanabe's desire to tattoo his name on his favorite actress's leg. Oh, yeah, well, he didn't quite make it, but you see, this is a, in a sense, a kind of reversal of the autograph problem, which is a, now how about this one? Get this one. All right, ready for the next one now? We have another one there. Here's a, it's happening everywhere.
I could, sir, you'll have a punch in the nose. Once again, the BBC brings you its special broadcast on its overseas service. Special broadcast salute to English society and Englishmen everywhere. We'll fight them in the hedgerows. We'll fight them on the beaches. We'll fight them with blood, sweat, and tears. Hey, God, sir, there'll always be an England. London, August 20th. Taking careful aim, John Moffat, a good Englishman, flicked a dot at the dartboard in his favorite pub. He hit a light bulb. This short-circuited the lights. In the darkness, pub keeper Bruce Newton started for the fuse box downstairs. He lost his footing and plunged down the stairs. This frightened the pub watchdog Bilko, and Bilko bit him smartly. The publican let out a yell, and a bartender smashed a glass and cut his hand. Then Newton got the lights back on, came upstairs, and found that someone had walked out with the dartboard. And so tonight we salute John Moffat and Bruce Newton as Englishmen embattled. Hey, God, there'll always be an England. Carry on, men. Good show.
So you see, no matter where you go, no matter where you go, it's bound to happen. Speaking of the big problem, this is WOR AM and FM New York. It's the problem we're talking about. You know, speaking of the problem, a couple of nights ago, we touched on a flying episode. If you remember the episode of the A-20 in Drew Field in Florida. And I'm surprised. I don't think there's any other subject in general of a technical nature. Now, it's nothing else, Don. You just watch. I'll point. That's all right. Don't worry. Just let it go. Okay. So of a technical nature, there's nothing of a technical nature I know of that gets people more excited than to mention flying to people today. I guess because most people have done a lot of flying. And yet, most people have not really done flying. The kind of flying that we do today, you know, getting in the airlines, and in fact, it's always been that way when passengers have been carried around, is in a sense a very lulling, and I might say in some ways a very artificial kind of flying. because almost everything in an airplane today is designed to make it so, or to make you feel like you're not flying. Because after all, flying is a it's a thing, you know that. And of course, automatically now, I'm going to get a lot of letters from ladies who are saying, well, it isn't. Well, I'll tell you, baby, all you've got to do is see about 3 good air crashes, and then you know that flying is not going out on a Sunday afternoon with hubby and taking up in your little airplane and going around the neighboring. And I know it's very safe. We're not arguing about that. We're not discussing whether it's safe or not. But flying is, and always has been, a highly exciting adventure. But more and more today, they're trying, since the world is becoming security conscious, more people today are worried about their skin than probably at any other time in history. More people are more egotistically involved in what's happening to me. This is a big issue. In fact, almost every really dedicated peace marcher I know, when finally pushed to the wall, will say the reason he's for peace is that he doesn't want to die. As if that's enough reason, you know, to be for, I don't know, maybe it is. I'm not going to argue that. But the fact is, this is the ultimate reason. And so, the airlines have spent a great amount of money. That special color that airliners are when you get inside of them. The special kind of curtains that are on the windows, the special sort of seats. The way the rugs are on the floor of the plane, the stewardess who is trained to, under all conditions, always be totally at ease, completely at ease. And of course, then they walk around, they give you booze, which kind of helps too, you see, for the more nervous types. And they very carefully keep you separated from the machinery of the airplane. They don't want to let you know that's a machine. And so you'll notice that there's a big doorway and a bulkhead up in front that you hardly ever see, what's up there. You know, all those meters and dials and those things that they pull and stuff. The machine really is kind of like an automatic thing. It just sort of, you get in, you take up, and you go, and you come back. But it's not quite that way. I wonder how many of you remember the broadcast that I did a year or two ago of reporting of the air crash out at Idlewild on a windy, bright March morning. You remember that? The day that Glenn was coming in? Well, I remember that vividly, of course. And I suppose a few people who heard it do, too. However, I remember, and listening tonight on the news, or was it last night? Tonight, I think I heard somebody talk about a carrier accident. I believe it was on the new Enterprise, the Big E, the Enterprise. Somebody snapped a cable, and the plane went over the side. Well, I was immediately reminded. I don't know how many of you have ever had the opportunity, and I'm sure that some of you have had, but the opportunity to do things which lie outside of the ordinary realm, the ordinary ken of experience, life experience in the 20th century. Now, by that I mean this. We are subjected to, as we live in our life, there are things that we all do. We ride in cars, we walk around, we go up and down in elevators, we go to the beach. We share probably 10,000 experiences that every one of us share. We go to the drive-in. We do things. We live a life that is pretty well within a set of circumstances and adventures, one kind or another. But then on the outside of that, beyond that, in all directions lie a series of things which only a few people have done. And once they have done these, they can never quite become. They're never the same. These things always change a person forever and ever and ever, without any question of a doubt. They do. They literally do change you. And for the people who lie, who walk and work and live within the set of accepted adventures, life experiences, they find it difficult to ever really communicate the one thing and the other, you see. And so it's like if you've ever been catapulted, for example, off the deck of a carrier under combat conditions, you will never, ever forget it. But to those who have been catapulted off, it is difficult for them to tell those who have never been catapulted off what it's like, even though those who have not done it probably think they know. It's impossible to describe it. Well, I've had this happen to me a couple of times. And I can say to you right now, in the darkness out there, out beyond Jones Beach, way out somewhere in the darkness, out in the Mediterranean, there are guys who are taking off and there are guys who are landing on aircraft carriers. This is an experience which I don't think, I know of no experience in life outside of that actual experience that even parallels it. Because I'll have to say this. You know that when you get in an airliner and you take off, you know that strange feeling you have the minute the plane taxis and they've battened down the hatches and it goes down to the end of the runway and she wheels around, she heads into the wind, and she starts to pick up speed. There is that feeling inside of almost every one of us. If you have any imagination at all, the unimaginative people probably don't have this feeling. But, because they usually sit there and they're buried immediately in their Reader's Digest. You notice that? Almost. And here they're doing something which is a tremendous experience, great, a great adventure. And most people immediately upon getting into an airplane will ask for the latest copy of Life. They'd much prefer looking at a picture of something than looking out of the window and seeing Queens at 8,000 feet below them. Now, this part, of course, I suppose, of the secret realization that we all have, that we are 8,000 feet above the ground and going 600 miles an hour, which is not quite a normal experience. But the in the carrier, you know that little feeling you have of it's all out of my hands now? That strange feeling that, well, I've committed myself. I have literally committed myself now, and everybody else on this plane has, and we are, there it is. It's out of my hands now. There's nothing I can do. That is at one hand a scary feeling. At the other hand, it is strangely reassuring, because mostly throughout life, you have a feeling that you are in control, and this gives you a sense always that you are lousing up. You know what I mean? A sense that somehow my life isn't working out. Somehow I'm not making it go right. Somehow if I had it to do over again, I would do this. But I can't get myself to do this. I can't make myself. Somehow I can't. I want to do this, but I can't. You know the feeling always that bugs most people? A little gnawing cloud of guppies with sharp teeth behind every person, gnawing away at them, saying, you're lousing up, you're lousing up. You should get on the stick, get going. What are you doing this for now? What are you sitting here having coffee for? Get on the stick. Come on now, get going. Your life is going by. Go on, get going, get going. Well, that one minute you get into that airplane and that airplane starts to take off, all those little guppies are left behind. Because this one instant, you are totally involved and at the same time totally uninvolved. You're a passenger. You cannot escape, and yet you are not responsible. It's a very interesting experience. And it people get hooked on it, by the way, almost the same way they get hooked on cocaine. It's leaving your responsibilities behind. They do not exist. And yet at the same time knowing secretly that there is a constant ever-present danger. It is there. You can't kid yourself. No matter how hard you work, it is there. Things fall. It's a law of physics, whether you like it or not. There it is. And you're always gambling. Well, I remember the first time I catapulted off a carrier. This carrier happened to be the Carrier Essex. For those of you who are interested in logistics or facts, it was the Carrier Essex, and at the time it was an attack carrier. Now I think it's a submarine warfare carrier, which is a different carrier classification. But at the time, the Essex was a CVA, or an attack carrier, and was one of the chief carriers in the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean at that time. And its sister carrier was a much larger carrier, and we'd see her once in a while over the horizon, and occasionally we'd go over and spend a day or two on her. But the sister carrier to the Essex, she wasn't a sister genealogically speaking, but only by the matter of the chart, was the Forrestal. She was over the horizon. Well, I remember being the funny thing of watching the planes coming and going and leaving, And coming, particularly at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I don't think there's any sight in the world that is remotely as truly dramatic and truly awe-inspiring. I such a word is scary to use, but it does inspire a kind of awe in you. And at the same time, a genuine fear, but a very vague one, a hard to put into words fear of machinery itself. The great brute strength and the smashing power of machines, just insane machines. Machines that are hot, machines that hiss and scream, and machines that move at unbelievable speeds and get totally out of control. I remember the first night I'm on the Essex. We got into the ship. We landed on the ship about 7 o'clock, and this is an exact reproduction of how it happened. We were flying in aboard there was four or five other guys in a plane called a COD. This is a Navy designation for a type of aircraft. It's a twin-engine aircraft that is used for ferrying personnel and mail and one thing or another. But oddly enough, this aircraft, in its own way, is one of the most dangerous of all aircraft because of its clumsiness to land on the deck of a carrier, especially one of the smaller carriers, such as the Essex class. Well, we're sitting in the COD here, and the COD is, everyone is seated in the Navy, of course, and in fact, I believe in most services today, the seating is the reverse of seating in the airlines. You're facing the rear of the plane, so that if there is an accident, you are pushed into the seat rather than pulled out of it by your own weight. So we're sitting in the COD. Now, most aircraft that are in actual service, as opposed to aircraft that we use for just flying around the States to Chicago or to Los Angeles, are not designed for the comfort of the people who are riding in them. They're designed to get from one place to the other at a minimum of expenditure of fuel and a few, of course, at a maximum of safety. But comfort, no, because comfort takes away from a lot of other things. You know, you get nothing in this world for nothing, particularly when you're hurtling through the air at several hundred miles an hour. You for every pound you take off of this, you must, you know, add it here. For every pound of extra jazz you put inside, it comes off of something else. And so these planes are pretty well stripped down. And we're sitting in the COD, facing backwards, and it's insanely hot in this airplane. And it was so happened that that day there was a strong crosswind blowing. It was around a 30 or 35 knot wind, a very, very strong wind. And the Essex had gone into the wind, and the pilot, we made a big circle over the Essex. And, of course, we'd been flying out of Beirut. In case you're interested in what we were flying out of, we come out of Beirut, and we flew about 80 or 90 miles out to sea, and finally there below us, we were flying at about 15,000 feet, was the Essex. Well, the Essex laying down there in that steaming hot ocean with the sun glancing off the deck, it roughly looked about the size of a very tiny, I'd say a small scratch on a pane of glass. The sun does funny things when you're at that altitude. They don't look like ships. They look like a little tiny sliver or a little chip of some kind. And so we made a big pass over the Essex, and down below us we could see a flight coming in. You could just see these little tiny white things moving over the surface of the water. One by one, you just see them disappear into this little slit, this little scratch on the pane of glass. Until finally, after three or four big, slow, lazy passes over the Essex, the pilot, who was sitting directly ahead of us, and his crew chief turned around, and he said, pull your belts as tight as you can. Just pull them as tightly as you can. Just pull them all the way tight. Pull your shoulders back. So they use the shoulder-type belt in these aircraft. Again, I say this is because of the problems of catapulting and the problems of landing on to go out to sea, and he heads into the wind and lower, and you can't see. That's the thing that adds to the interest of you can see nothing now at this point. You are totally committed. And suddenly he begins to drop, and you can hear those big brakes flopping down, the great big old, he drops his flaps, and you hear, the plane sort of hovers for a minute, and you get that funny sensation in the stomach of being just on the edge of stalling. Just on the edge. And if you've done any flying at all outside of big airliners, you know the feeling. It's a sudden feeling that the elevator is either, you can't tell whether it's going to go up or going to go down. Shh. And he's got his prop feathered back, and then there was an instant where you see that deck hurtling past you just for a second, and then she hits, and the plane pitches forward. You sit back, and she belts up, boom, boom, boom. You hear a giant thump inside, and she just sort of sits there for a second, and there is a moment of almost total silence. Oh, boy, you look out, and immediately he starts to taxi away. You hear the guys, see two or three guys running past in yellow T-shirts and yellow helmets. They're pulling it out of the flight pattern because something else is coming in, and there you are, you see. Well, taking off now is another story. It's a completely different story, especially if you are, there are two ways to take off from a carrier, of course. There's the direct prop method, which was used largely during World War II, of a plane is held back, his motor is revved up to a certain point, he almost gains, and they head into the wind. You know, I wonder how often this has been reported on, that when a carrier is heading into the wind, and she's got all the coal poured into her as they pour everything she's got into the carrier when the planes are taking off, that a carrier of the Essex class will probably cut through the water at 35 or 40 knots. She really goes. And this is a good mileage. You know, a knot is longer than a mile, you know. And so she's going into the wind, and the wind itself is maybe anywhere from 15 to 20 to 30 knots. So when you're on the deck of a carrier, that wind is whistling over the deck at maybe 85 to 100 miles an hour sometimes. And just standing on the deck of the carrier. So it's a very exciting moment being on that carrier. You get the sense of standing on the top of some giant automobile or something that's going insanely fast. The wind is howling through the bridge and everything is going, and your ears are flapping. And of course, everybody aboard on topside on a carrier, this is probably the world's most dangerous place to be. There's no place more dangerous that I know of, other than perhaps being on the top of an enormous structural iron job here in Midtown Manhattan in the middle of a rainstorm and a lightning storm with a tornado coming up. It's roughly the same thing. A fellow just a day or two before, to give you an idea of the kind of accidents they have, a day or two before we landed on the Essex, a plane landed, and when she landed, her tail hook somehow hit a metal cover that was over a deck light, a flush deck light that was sunken down into the deck. And, you know, they have these deck lights that are flat. They're very heavily armored. But somehow his tail hook or something, it was a tail hook that hit it, and the cover came off. This thing, the cover, sailed the entire length of the Essex, like you had, as if you had taken a big flat pie tin and sailed it out over the water. This thing sailed the entire length of the Essex, and down at the other end where they were parking planes, there was a crew chief, a chief who'd been in the Navy maybe 18 or 20 years, was directing traffic down there, when suddenly this pie tin sailed past him just like that. No head. And everyone sort of stood around, because it happened so quickly, and the thing was moving so fast that no one even saw the pie tin fly, just whoosh, down the length of the deck. And the length of that deck is close to perhaps 800 or 900 feet long. So he was a good, well, how many blocks is 800 or 900 feet? He was a good 4 blocks away from where the plane was landing. So these are the kind of accidents that happen. Well, we got aboard this carrier, and a couple of days later, I'm ready to go. And this, at that time, it was combat conditions. They were flying every 24 hours, or every 24 hours, they were flying a 24-hour trick all around the clock. Every 90 minutes, a flight would take off out on patrol duty out over Lebanon and Syria. They were flying over Iran and over the coast, and then they would do their patrol and come back. And then as they land, another crew was being raised up, another flight, and they would take off. Dark, it makes no difference. Well, I remember the first night watching the planes come in. Now, these are jets, of course. At that time, they were flying A-4Ds. You know the plane that went into the ocean here the other day that the guy was picked up from? The Russians picked him up, the 86. They were flying some old 86s, too, out there at that time, known in the Navy as Banjos. That's the designation of that particular type of aircraft. Very strange look when she comes in. the Seaborne F-86. Well, they were flying those types of planes. There were three or four others that they were trying at the time, but the chief aircraft aboard the Essex at the time was the A-4D, which was a single-engine fighter-bomber, a Delta design, of just slightly below the speed of sound. It's a pretty fast aircraft. And this was an awful small carrier for that kind of aircraft. And so at 2 o'clock in the morning, under total darkness conditions, there not a single light aboard the ship. As I say, this was combat conditions. This was at the time of the, do you recall, the Lebanese landings? 1958 it was, I believe. Yeah, August of 58. So there was total combat conditions. At the time, there had been reported something like 14 to 17 Russian submarines in the fleet that were making observations on the Essex and various other ships of the line at that time. So they were using combat conditions. Well, I remember going up topside at 2 o'clock in the morning, up into the bridge, up into the to the island, up around maybe 10 or 11, up pretty high up off the deck. And these, they're beginning to wave in a flight. Well, of course, they don't use the system that they used during the war, the old waving system. This is a completely different system, the meatball system they use. They also use, naturally radar, various types of flying devices. But these planes coming in the dark, they come in, and of course, the trick of flying and landing on a carrier is the speed with which it's done. The most vulnerable moment for a carrier is when planes are coming aboard. Because for one thing, the aircraft, of course, are low on fuel. So if they're attacked, there's not very much they can do. Their speed is cut way down at that point. And usually when they come into the pattern, they have disarmed themselves for obvious reasons. They've cut off their armament so that they don't have problems with exploding equipment due to malfunction when they land. So the planes are literally, absolutely at the mercy of anything that happens. So they have to land very fast and be taken out of their landing slot, moved off to the hangar deck, and another one comes in. They were landing aircraft at between 10 and 15 second intervals. Just look at your watch, and you will see how fast that is. That means a guy, shoom, boom. What a great sound that is when they come in the dark. And you can see that long line. Once in a while, they throw on their landing lights. You just see a little, not their landing lights, but their running lights, a little red light come on as the planes are coming in this great big counterclockwise circle, flying in a great circle around the carrier. And one by one, they come in. And you'd hear the bullhorn, the great loudspeaker. Boy, the total darkness, remember. And all around me in the dark are these sailors standing up behind the barriers. You see, the barriers are all heavily armored, both from gunfire and for airplanes crashing, all heavily armored. And they're standing behind these barriers with movie cameras, taking pictures of each landing. These are the vultures. They are called the vultures by the flyers. And so there may be 15 or 20 of these guys everywhere, just taking pictures of every landing with 8mm cameras, little Bell and Howell cameras. The point being that if there is a crash, they want to have it on film so they can watch it. It's like the Saturday morning quarterbacks looking at the pictures of last night's fiasco. So the pilot, as he comes in, he sees all those cameras trained on him. It's a very interesting feeling. They call them the vultures. And these guys will stand around up on the island. And if you get them going, they'll talk about great pictures they've taken. Great moments in vulture life. One guy told me about the time he was quietly standing up topside and absolutely routine landing. And he's up there and a couple of other guys, and they're not paying much attention. The planes have been coming in and going. It was on training, you know, one of those things that goes on and on. And he's up there taking pictures when suddenly the plane came in. And as she came in, you see there are five, at least on the Essex, there were five different cables. If the plane lands and he misses the first three cables, the fourth one will get him, you see. If he misses the last cable, generally that's a wave off, you see. He goes up. Well, if you catch the last cable, however, and the last cable breaks, there's trouble. So this plane came in, and she made a landing, very routine landing. She hooked the last cable, and that thing just pulls that big old cable, stretches like an enormous rubber band, you know. And she went, this thing went right across the deck, and there was an entire flight of aircraft waiting to take off. They were wings folded. They were waiting down at the other end. Actually, they were just hangar down on the other end of the ship, and she just, boom, boom, boom. She bounced from one airplane to the other. And in fact, before it was over, there were 11 aircraft burning and exploding on the deck of the Essex. And he had it all on film. A very interesting film. This might interest you too. There wasn't even a single person hurt. Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. I saw the films, you wouldn't believe it. This, it looks like the whole carrier is on fire and people are running and scurrying. But the feeling of getting out finally topside, and you know you're going to take off in a jet, you're going to take off, and the particular jet that I was flying in, we were flying a specific mission, and I was flying piggyback, by the way, in case you're fascinated with details. Piggyback means two guys in a one-man airplane. And that's a special, but they do it. This is done quite often. It's not unsafe or anything. It's just very uncomfortable, that's all. Not only is it very uncomfortable, you cannot believe how hot it is and also how cold it gets. And there's more to it than that. But the night before, I had gone down below, and the pilot that I was to fly with, we'd been talking about the flight we were to fly, and we were checking out the equipment. Particularly the radar equipment and so on. We've been talking it over, and we went up on the hangar deck. Now the hangar deck is two or three decks below the flight deck on a carrier. The hangar deck is literally that. This is where the aircraft are hangared. And so we walked the whole length of the hangar deck. It's a tremendous deck, and it's open. It's a beautiful. Somehow I find the hangar deck one of the most exciting decks aboard an aircraft carrier. Open on both sides, and the sea is racing past, and these airplanes are all fastened down. And there's a certain strange feeling of excitement on that deck. It can't be put into words either. I've hardly ever seen this in the movies, the hangar deck of an aircraft carrier. And so we went down the length, and finally we came to his aircraft, and we checked it out, and we talked about it. And she's standing there in the shadows, and this big old A4D is laying there. And the next morning at 3 o'clock, I'm yanked out of my sack, and we get up topside. We have a couple of cups of coffee, and we're put into our suits. We go out of the ready room. We're talking it over. They have a blackboard, and we go out at tops. And all up to this point had been very normal behavior. You see, we all have gone through things very similar to this. And then we went up on the elevator up to the top deck, up to the flight deck, walked across the flight deck, and there, hanging off over the sea, was a little A4D. It was the only one up there because we were going on a reconnaissance flight, not part of the regular flight. And so we walked across the deck, and she's burrowing into the sun. You can just see just vague sun coming up now. It's about 4:30, and it's hot puffs of wind, and that great blast of the gale is coming across the deck, and we're bucking as she heads into the sea. And you can hear that, prepare for takeoff, aircraft, we're heading into the wind, prepare for takeoff, And we head on the wind, she picks up, and you can feel the speed picking up. We get into this A4D, and the crew chief is out there, we climb up the ladder, and he turns us around, and he fools a little with the controls, and next thing you know, she's going. They make a sound like a very fast gas burner. If you put your ear over it. And he touches the button, and that big, great, big green glass bubble greenhouse seals us in. And we're sitting up over the deck now. We're about at least two stories above the deck. A good two stories, 20 to 22, 23 feet above the deck. We're pushed down to the end, and we sit there. And I see the crewman down there. And Gil, the pilot, is on the intercom talking up to the control tower. Yeah, okay. And then suddenly they all scurry. He pours the coal to it, and we sit. Everybody's gone. We are sitting there looking out over the sea. And believe me, for the first time in my life, I knew I had no control over anything. This was it. And then, boom! You feel the sinking. In an instant, the ship is gone. You just feel something go down, 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 down. The sea coming up. Up we go. Up. We're off the deck of the carrier. All I know is that for that one brief moment, there is no control at all over anything.
And speaking of no control at all, you're tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. You've been listening to the Dustbin of History. You want to hear that other Bradbury-Cohen collaboration next week? Like I say, it's not fantasy, it's not science fiction, but we have it. If you want to hear it, let me know on the Facebook page, The Dustbin of History. Or you can write to me, max@wbai.org. That's my email address, max@wbai.org. Okay, I'm Max Schmid, your curator and janitor. I thank you for listening. I urge you to support this radio station. Go to wbai.org and look for ways to donate, won't you? Coming up in a moment, the Jimmy Dore Show, followed by What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Produced by Paul Fisher. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week or Sunday night for the Golden Age of Radio, 8 to 10, right here on WBAI New York.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal. Well, I'm going to go to the bathroom.